people still missing. U.S. Southern Command says it is supporting search and rescue efforts. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A controversial state fair celebrating 250 years of America is underway on the National Mall. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Tied to America 250 celebrations, more National Guard troops deploy to Washington, D.C. The actor and director Olivia Wilde talks to A about making and acting in a new film called The Invite. She plays a wife in a marriage on the rocks. It's Friday, June 26th. Happy birthday to singer, songwriter, and guitarist Chris Isaak, perhaps best known for his haunting song, Wicked Game. He's 70 today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Supreme Court has cleared the way for the Trump administration to begin ending temporary protected status for hundreds of thousands of immigrants. For many, the next question is what happens when those protections expire? NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports.
They need to either adjust their status, which is very limited ways of doing so, or they need to leave the country. If they don't, they risk falling out of status, and that could lead to an arrest, a detention, or a deportation. And many also face losing their jobs, as companies will not be able to continue legally employing thousands of workers.
That's NPR's Jimena Bustillo reporting. The Supreme Court's decision could also clear the way for the Trump administration to return to court and seek to reinstate efforts to end temporary protected status for people from a number of countries. President Trump's push to overhaul U.S. elections is facing pushback on Capitol Hill. The president says he won't sign any legislation until Congress passes what's known as the Save America Act. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports the measure has little chance of advancing in the Senate.
Trump has said he believes the Save America Act would ensure Republicans never lose another election, as his party faces a potentially bruising election cycle this fall. If passed, the law would prohibit states from registering voters who don't provide proof of citizenship. That includes birth certificates, passports, and some state and tribal IDs. Citizenship is already required to register to vote, and according to experts, non-citizen voting is extremely rare. The law would also require voter ID for ballots cast both in person and by mail. The bill would also force states to hand over sensitive voter data to the Trump administration. It does not currently have the 60 votes needed in the Senate to overcome a filibuster. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Apple is raising prices amid a shortage of computer memory chips. NPR's John Ruwitch reports.
Apple quietly boosted prices on its website for a range of products, including MacBooks and iPads. In many cases, prices went up around 15 to 20%. So, for instance, a 14-inch MacBook Pro that cost $1,699 yesterday, according to archived web pages, now starts at $1,999. Apple TV 4K is now $199 instead of $129. For Apple's most popular product, the iPhone, it kept prices flat. The rapid expansion of AI data centers has created a surge in demand for memory and storage, leading to a spike in chip prices. Apple says that's created an unprecedented challenge for the entire consumer electronics industry. Apple says it shielded customers for a while, but the cost of memory chips has reached a point where it needs to start raising prices. Several other major players have already done so. John Ruwitch, NPR News.
Apple is a financial supporter of NPR. This is NPR. King Charles has become the first British monarch to publish his taxes. The palace also says he and Queen Camilla will no longer make Buckingham Palace their home. These are part of the king's efforts to make the monarch more transparent amid scandals involving his brother Andrew. NPR's Lauren Frere reports from London.
Next year, Buckingham Palace finishes renovations that cost nearly $500 million. But the king and queen say they'll continue living at Clarence House across the street. The palace will remain the ceremonial and operational center of the monarchy and be able to host more tourists and events. Meanwhile, the king's tax bill shows he paid nearly $17 million last year, putting him in the top 100 UK taxpayers. He's not required to pay income or property tax, but his late mother, Queen Elizabeth, started voluntarily doing so, and Charles followed. He's published details for transparency, but critics say it's not enough and want a breakdown of how these figures were calculated. Taxpayer funding for the royals is rising next year, mostly for upkeep of palaces and properties. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
The State Board of Education in Texas is expected to vote today on a required reading list for more than 5 million public school students. The list includes stories and passages from the Bible. Supporters say it reflects the role of Christianity in American history. Critics argue it blurs the line between church and state and gives teachers and students too little flexibility over what they read. On Wall Street, Dow futures are down 51 points at this hour. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia. For 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org.
Hey, it's Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition. 50 years ago, KAXE became the first rural public radio station in the nation, serving northern Minnesota. 50 years ago, the first rural public radio station in the United States. Great public radio starts with a mission, to serve the community. From Morning Edition to All Things Considered to the local news and the Up North Report, KAXE keeps you informed. The goal is to strengthen civic health in rural northern Minnesota. Let's think about that, civic health, by making local government and elections more understandable and accessible and transparent before, during, and after the vote. So congratulations on 50 years to KAXE.
Your membership has gotten us here to 50 years of KAXE. Do your part. Text the word donate, 218-326-1234.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Rescuers in Venezuela continue their search for thousands of people missing after two devastating earthquakes struck in quick succession on Wednesday night.
The quakes hit the capital and surrounding areas, causing widespread destruction and overwhelming local response efforts. Venezuelan officials now say at least 235 people are confirmed dead and warn the toll is likely to rise as the search continues.
In a few minutes, we'll speak with one of the aid workers helping with search and rescue operations in Caracas. But first, we'll go to Manuel Rueda, who is in neighboring Colombia. Manuel, good morning.
Good morning.
You've actually been able to get in touch with people on the ground. What are they telling you about conditions there?
Well, basically what people are saying is that some parts of Caracas look like a war zone because many buildings have collapsed entirely. And also in La Guaira, which is a city about an hour away on the Caribbean coast. And because so many buildings have collapsed, thousands of people have lost their homes. They're sleeping in parks at night. Even people who perhaps their building didn't collapse are sleeping outside because they're afraid of the replicas from the earthquake. So basically what humanitarian groups are saying in Venezuela is that this is going to be a very long effort to support these people. You know, these people are going to need food, shelter, medicines. So this is going to take several weeks. They're going to need support for several weeks there to get back on their feet.
And what about right now? Like, how is the search and rescue operation working? I mean, it just sounds like the conditions there are really horrific.
Yeah, what you have right now is hundreds of people also trapped inside the rubble, inside buildings, and some of these people are still alive and desperately waiting for help. Venezuela doesn't have much experience dealing with major earthquakes because they just don't happen there so often. It's not like California or Japan. Some journalists have been trying to speak to people who are trapped inside buildings. This is a clip from the city of La Guaira where a journalist is trying to get people to scream out their names to prove that they're alive.
¿Cómo te llamas, hermano?
Anthony. El otro. Ramón. Y el otro. Ari.
So you can see there that you can sort of hear their voices muffled because these people are just behind several feet of concrete, like inside a hole or very deep inside a building, and they can't get out.
And it's not exactly a secret that Venezuela's economy has been severely strained for a number of years. You've certainly written reporting on that. You know, the economy is strained. You know, the health services is strained. The infrastructure in general has been under pressure. So do they think that they can cope with the scale of this disaster?
Yeah, I mean, the government of Venezuela is going to need major economic support for rebuilding and even for the humanitarian response. I mean, this is a government that's only paying public servants $200 a month because they're so broke. Any public servant in Venezuela, a teacher, a nurse, only gets paid $200 a month. It's a place where inflation is at 500% annually. So this is going to be a big shock for Venezuela's economy. So it's not only just the rescue teams right now you need, you know, the immediate response to help people, but how do you help the country recover some of its infrastructure after that? The nation's main airport has also been damaged. So that's going to be another investment. You're going to need to get that up and running. So it's, yeah, it seems like it's they're going to need support on many fronts to recover from this earthquake.
That's Manuel Rueda. He's reporting from neighboring Colombia. Manuel, thank you.
Absolutely.
For more on the rescue efforts, we turn to Cesar Jimenez with Project Hope in Venezuela. His group is a global health and humanitarian aid organization which deploys teams to provide medical and search and rescue assistance. Cesar is in the capital and joins me now. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. Thanks to you for the opportunity.
First, are you, your family, your colleagues at Project Hope all safe?
Yes, thankfully, all of the Project Hope Venezuela team is doing okay, only with minor structural damage in their households, and my family, and a lot of my relatives are okay as well.
Now, you are part of these rescue efforts. What have you been seeing as your teams are deployed?
Okay, so our teams deployed the very night of the earthquake, and we deployed to assess the frontline ambulatory network. In some locations, we found moderate damage to facades, meaning that the buildings are safe enough to remain operational. But in others, the structural stability is complete compromise, and we cannot risk treating patients inside facilities that are vulnerable to collapse from all of these aftershocks, you know.
So what does that mean, though?
For the centers that...
What does that mean for rescue efforts if you're worried about going into buildings that might collapse?
Well, for the centers that remain stable, our priority is supporting the medical staff.
Okay.
So despite all of the lack of power and communications, our team, our rapid response team, are doing an outstanding job using using all of the efforts to assess all of the realities, you know?
Yeah.
It's actually pretty devastating and heartbreaking scene right now in La Guaira, specifically.
Yeah. Describe some of that for me. What are you seeing?
Yeah,
how are
because,
people holding up?
Yeah. Maybe more than 40 or 50 buildings partially or totally collapsed. I'm talking about businesses, households, hotels entirely, maybe 15 or to 20 stories building totally collapsed with a lot of people inside, a lot of pets, kids, pregnant women. It's really heartbreaking. And there are still hundreds of people trapped under the buildings. Actually, local civil protection teams are working, trying to retrieve all of these people, but we're running out of time, you know. And thankfully, all of the humanitarian aid is underway. The country, we have seen planes from El Salvador, Mexico, Switzerland, the United States. We're very thankful for that. And they're coming, a lot of volunteers, a lot of search and rescue teams and with canine units, a lot of humanitarian aid, like water, medical supplies, medical equipment, pharmaceuticals. So all of the international support, it's welcome right now.
You mentioned we're running out of time as you try to save people who are under these collapsed buildings. What would you say are the most pressing needs right now? What does Venezuela need?
Well, as for now, we need, you know, as a country, and as I was saying before in another spaces, I think no country is ever prepared for this kind of catastrophic emergency, you know. As the other colleague was saying, we were not prepared in structurally within the healthcare system. We're not prepared to receive a lot of people injured and with a need to receive medical support. As for now, we as country need a lot of support with medical supplies, with water, with medical equipment, with volunteers, with search and rescue team, more search and specialized search and rescue teams.
Cesar Jimenez joins us from Caracas, Venezuela, where he is working with a Project Hope team to provide medical and other humanitarian aid after Wednesday's earthquakes. Thank you so much for joining, and I hope you come back on the program to update us on this work ahead.
Okay. Thank you.
Houston, Texas is home to one of the nation's largest Venezuelan communities. After two powerful earthquakes killed at least 235 people in Venezuela, many are turning their worry into action to help families back home. Here's Lucille Vasquez with the Texas Newsroom.
In a hot cargo garage in Katy, a Houston suburb, volunteers at a pop-up donation drive packed boxes with canned tuna, diapers, and medicine. Many were Venezuelans living in the U.S. trying to help from thousands of miles away. Eriana Ricardia first came early Thursday to donate hygiene items like pads, tampons, and body soap. Then she stayed to help pack boxes.
One thing I admire about being Venezuelan is our resilience, being there for each other, and then just supporting each other during the tough times.
Ricardia was with her mother when she learned of two devastating earthquakes that struck Venezuela Wednesday night. She called her grandmother in Caracas. Ricardia was relieved to hear her voice. She was safe. But relief quickly gave way to a different feeling, the need to help.
Being far away from a family and being outside and being part of the outside is very important for us to come together and support our people.
Venezuelan officials on Thursday night said there may be hundreds of people still trapped under debris. The Trump administration has already pledged $150 million for relief efforts. And throughout the country, donation drives have opened, including here in Katy, which has one of the largest Venezuelan communities in the country. People around here call it Katyzuela, a place dotted with dozens of Venezuelan-owned businesses like bakeries and restaurants. At another nearby donation site at Mi Querencia Latin Market, Amelia Millan was also moved to donate after seeing the destruction in her home country. She says her family in Venezuela is safe, but many of their homes were badly damaged.
I wish I could get on a plane and be there right now. Believe me, my heart and my mind are there right now. It's very hard to concentrate on work or anything else.
Back inside the hot cargo garage, volunteers sorted donations for hours. Between packing boxes, many paused to write messages of support on a wall near the garage's entrance, beside a Venezuelan flag. One message read, "Estamos contigo, Venezuela." We are with you, Venezuela. For NPR News, I'm Lucio Vasquez.
This is NPR News.
Minutes after 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to KAXE and the Friday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Joining me at 6:30, Heidi Holton, and we'll bring you National Native News plus our Talk Back segment. Always great to hear from our listeners.
Whatever your thoughts may be about what you hear, text us at 218-326-1234. And you can answer our question of the week. We want to hear about the small town festivals that mean something to you or the ones that you feel that people just can't miss. Text us at 218-326-1234. Support comes from the First National Bank of Coleraine. Since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at coleranebank.com, member FDIC. And we thank Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More at dalesautobodyinc.com. Partly sunny today, highs near 75, winds from the southeast 5 to 15. Our lows tonight 52 to 58, and tomorrow partly sunny, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s with breezy southeast wind. Looking ahead to Sunday, there is a chance of showers and thunderstorms with highs in the upper 70s to low 80s. More news is next.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Clarivate, celebrating the 150th anniversary of the American Library Association and its support for libraries, library workers, and everyone they serve. Learn more at ALA.org. From Bayer, who believes science is the relentless process of asking questions, testing, and trying again, even when it's not easy. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. From Schwab, offering the Schwab Teen Investor Account, where teens can gain hands-on investing experience. It's co-owned by parents and teens, so parents can monitor the account while teens learn how to invest. More at schwab.com. And from the Kauffman Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. At the beginning of the new film, The Invite, a line from an Oscar Wilde play pops up on the screen. It goes, "One should always be in love. That is the reason one should never marry." The Invite is a story of a marriage on the ropes. Olivia Wilde, no relation to Oscar, plays Angela. Seth Rogen plays Joe. They are at each other's throats right from the start.
What is this?
That's a rug.
Did you buy this rug because the neighbors are coming?
Oh my God.
Angela is frantically preparing to host a dinner party for a mysterious new couple living in the apartment above them. Joe is not keen on having them over. The couple brings a dessert to the party and a shocking proposal.
Just to be clear, you, you, her, and me.
Yes.
Me too.
Yes, also you.
The Invite was directed by Olivia Wilde. When we meet her character, Angela is a big ball of anxiety.
She is existing on top of a very powerful fault line of tension. And like many people in relationships that last, you know, about 20 years, which is Angela and Joe at the point we meet them, she started out in a way that was a lot more relaxed and then has kind of become unrecognizable to herself, let alone her husband. And I think that Joe, Seth Rogen's character, is in a very similar place. He gave up his dream of being a musician and also has this sense of, if we can keep this family intact, we have not failed, even if we are deeply unhappy.
How do you get past that? Well, don't you, like, reach out to your best friend, your spouse, to try and work these things out? But it seems like they never say a word to each other about these kind of things.
They don't. I think the last person most people turn to in that state is the person they really should, which is the other person experiencing it, because it would be too painful to acknowledge that it's real. I think that they would have probably continued on in this state if not for this kind of combustion that occurs on the night that the movie takes place, which is when their neighbors come for dinner. I think without this moment, they'd probably still be living that way.
And their neighbors, Ed Norton and Penelope Cruz, they play the mysterious couple in the apartment above them.
It took you a while to come to the door. And it sounded like you were arguing.
No filter.
No, I just want to be honest. We were at the door before we rang, and we could hear you were fighting.
Oh, we were fighting. We were fighting, yeah.
Bit of a contentious environment in here, so I understand if that's repellent to you. No hard feelings, you know what I mean? Completely understand, you know?
We love a contentious environment.
You hit the jackpot then, my friend. You're in for a treat.
So, the character that you play and that Seth plays, you guys are kind of noisy with each other in that you're arguing a lot. Now, Hawk and Pina, they're also noisy too, but in a kind of a different way.
Very different way, yes. So in the beginning of the film, it's revealed that Joe in particular, Seth's character, has been kind of plagued by this constant noise of our neighbors having sex loudly above us. And it is extreme, and it's driving him nuts. And he is threatening that this will be the night he will bring up how loud they are. And it's sort of this guillotine hanging over Angela's head the whole film that Joe will bring up the noise.
And you know what is so funny about this, Olivia, is that when I think about people that make noise complaints of any kind, I always wonder what the root of the complaint is. Does a noise represent something they wish they were a part of too, or maybe that they used to have?
Exactly. It's just rubbing in their faces that they aren't having sex. And these neighbors are not like 20-year-old kids. It's not like, oh, the college kids upstairs are really loud. And it is a couple that is a little bit older than Joe and Angela. And that, I think, is even harder for him because it is confronting the fact that it is a choice to give up one's connection to one's sexuality and certainly in that relationship. It's not this inevitability. It's putting into focus for him his own failure.
I mean, they're having a lot of sex, but that also doesn't necessarily mean that they're 100% happy either.
Correct. Yeah. It was very important to me that we not suggest that this other couple is perfect because they have sex all the time and they never fight. And in fact, they do fight. And we kind of see them demonstrate for Joe and Angela that there is beauty in rupture and repair. It's not about whether or not you fight. It's how you recover.
What do you think makes for a great marriage? I'm doing air quotes, a quote-unquote great marriage.
You know, we had a great consultant on this film who's Esther Perel. She is an expert in relationships. She is adamant that the core of a great relationship is really honesty and communication, which doesn't mean full transparency to the point where you have to know absolutely everything about your partner and they you. I actually think that many people mistake love for melding. It's not actually that.
So I need to ask that when you said about honesty and transparency. So like when my wife comes up to me and says, how does this blouse look on me?
You know exactly what to say.
Am I being honest or
yes.
Or do I want to just
you are being,
all of a sudden not speak for 3 days?
You are looking at the question behind the question, which is, am I worthy of love in this blouse? And the answer is yes, you look...
That's a different way. See, okay, so if she were to ask it that way, of course, the answer would be yes, yes, 1,000 times yes.
None of us are ever asking what we're asking, are we?
Yeah, I guess not. For me, the biggest thing that this film did really well was showing how very serious, intense-sounding arguments between married couples can be really funny and even silly at a distance or in retrospect. I mean, you don't know how many times my wife and I have remembered an argument from 10 years ago and kind of laughed at it.
Yes, it cracked up. That's the best feeling. I love that feeling. And I do think that Joe and Angela, they're very funny together. Like, I think that there is a bit of Lucy and Desi in this couple. They actually do make each other laugh. There are several points in the film where Seth would make me break with his improv lines that you can see that I'm actually just incapable of holding it back. And I kept those in because I think even when Angela is so angry at her husband, she can't help but laugh. He makes her laugh even when they're sobbing. And if you laugh at it, I think you can prevent a lot of sadness.
That is Olivia Wilde. She stars in a new film she's directed. It's called The Invite. Olivia, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
In the new Steven Spielberg film Disclosure Day, there exists a higher power.
Why would he make such a vast universe, yet save it only for us?
I'm Scott Detrow. How faith leaders have been thinking about aliens in real life. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Did he say aliens in real life? No. That was us talking about aliens. I'm not sure, but All Things Considered is coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KEXE. It's 6:29. I'm Heidi Holton. That's Jennifer Barr sitting in for Malachi Coons.
Good morning.
Good morning. Malachi, though, is going to be joining us from his continental trip, he thinks, on Football is Life later today, 8:40.
Yeah, if it all works out, I hope it does, because I believe Football is Life, but I don't have a lot of things to say about it.
We don't need to say a thing. We've got DJ, even if it was only DJ Dang, but I'm sure Chris Walker will be coming in. I've got a little secret guest that might be joining us today. Ooh. So we don't need to worry about that. I've watched a couple, but I have nothing really to say about it because it's like a new thing for me. I'm not really watching it for the game. But it is pretty amazing how active, how much is going on. I thought it was maybe a slow game because of that you don't get that many points or something can end nil-nil.
Right.
You know, so I was like, oh, maybe it's slow. It's not slow. It's not slow at all.
No, they're running.
Yeah. It's that big field and really fun way to kind of learn about the world too, I find, because we're finding ourselves looking up, what is this country? I don't know this country.
Oh, yeah.
Curacao is one that we were watching. Yeah. Didn't know anything about it. There you go. They'll be telling us about what's going on right now. I think the U.S. played last night. There was an update on Morning Edition today. We'll maybe hear from that as well. So thanks for being with us. We'd love to have you be with us throughout the morning show and text us 218-326-1234. We're going to hear from National Native News next. The U.S. is celebrating 250 years since the Declaration of Independence, but some Native Americans in the Mount Rushmore state are turning their focus to a different anniversary. So stay tuned for that story. We've got Up North Report. We've got talkbacks. We've got some music. Marshall's away. It's busy times.
Yeah, busy, but... yeah, we're going to have a great morning show. And coming up at 9 o'clock, Andrew DeZingle, your host for Headwaters today. And then we will have Minnesota Mixtape with Malachi Coons. Weather for today, partly sunny, highs near 76, winds from the southeast 5 to 15. Mostly cloudy overnight with a slight chance of showers, lows 52 to 58. And for tomorrow, partly sunny, highs 77 to 82. That breezy southeast wind up to 25 miles per hour. For Saturday night, temps in the mid-50s to low 60s, chance of rain and thunderstorms. And then Sunday, showers, possible thunderstorms, mostly cloudy with highs in the upper 70s to mid-80s.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. The U.S. is celebrating the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, but some Native American people in the Mount Rushmore state are turning their focus to a different anniversary. South Dakota Searchlight's Megan O'Brien reports.
Ben Jones is South Dakota's state historian. He also chairs the state's America 250 Commission. He wants it to be an inclusive celebration.
So there was just a strong desire personally, and I think among all the members of the commission, that we include everybody who lives in South Dakota to be a part of this.
But as the 4th of July nears, Trina Lone Hill is not planning to celebrate.
For me personally, you know, the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence is very, I guess, like a slap in the face.
Lone Hill is a former historic preservation officer for the Oglala Sioux tribe. Now she serves on its tribal council. The founding of the country meant lost land, language, and culture for indigenous people. So Lone Hill's focus is on the 150th anniversary of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, the week before Independence Day. The conflict on June 25, 1876, was a major victory for the Northern Cheyenne, Arapaho, Lakota, and Dakota people. It happened during the United States encroachment on their land after the discovery of gold in the Black Hills. Lakota people know the conflict as the Battle of the Greasy Grass. Representatives of several tribes are working with the National Park Service to commemorate the anniversary at the battlefield in Montana. Lone Hill will be one of more than a dozen speakers at the three-day event. For National Native News, I'm Megan O'Brien.
The Indian Health Service is preparing to close one of its three locations in Arizona. The agency says this is part of a plan to modernize operations and improve health outcomes. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrasio reports, state Democrats are raising alarm.
More than 28,000 patients depend on the Tucson area office, especially members from the Fonoa'afam Nation and Pasquayaki tribe. It mostly handles administrative work, but is expected to merge with the IHS Phoenix office. That location is already responsible for 180,000 patients in Arizona, Nevada, and Utah.
Consolidating one to another, you're going to have a disruption of service. Any cut is going to cause a delay.
Arizona Democratic State Representative Brian Garcia, who is Pascua Yaqui, is concerned. So too is fellow tribal member Sally Ann Gonzalez, a Democratic state senator who also chairs the Indigenous Peoples Caucus.
I've never been to that clinic, but I know that some of our members do. And I used to represent Tohono'atam, and it's in their San Javier district. So it's disheartening to learn of its closure.
Arizona State Democrats sent a letter to Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy earlier this month, urging him to halt the looming closure. The agency did not comment on the letter. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The nominee to lead the Indian Health Service appeared before a Senate committee Tuesday. Mark Cruz, a citizen of the Klamath Tribes, answered questions from lawmakers during his confirmation hearing to become the next director of the Indian Health Service. Cruz currently serves as senior advisor for Native Affairs at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. According to the Indian Health Service, Cruz told senators he would focus on strengthening tribal consultation, improving health care access, and addressing workforce shortages across Indian country if confirmed. His nomination now moves forward in the Senate confirmation process. The Indian Health Service provides care to about 2.8 million American Indians and Alaskan Natives. I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding in part by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. Got some talkbacks coming up, some music for you, the set list. How excited are you for tomorrow, Jennifer? I mean, I know it's 6:36 in the morning. Yay!
Yeah, I'm pretty excited to go hang out in downtown Bemidji and hear some live music. Got some really fun bands coming tomorrow. Sonny Johnson, Cage Jamber, Tiny Town. Those are kind of more on the local side. And then Eric Koskin and David Huckfelt and Little Fevers, who are, you know, better known throughout the state. And there's going to be food and beverages and family-friendly activities.
Bubble Station.
Oh, I love bubbles.
Wow, this is a new thing. I did not know about you.
Like when I was a kid. Yeah.
Not currently. You don't bubble now?
I don't bubble, but, you know, I'm not opposed to it. I think there's nothing wrong with...
Might open you up for, like, adult bubbling.
Okay. It sounds like something, but, no, I had, like... And I'm sure Headwaters Science Center is going to have all kinds of fun stuff, but, like, I had one of those, like, it was, like, a piece of cloth, and it, like, made, like, this big, you know, like, it expanded, and then it made this big... You can make big bubbles with it.
Oh, okay.
I had one of those when I was a kid. Yep. My dog loved bubbles. She always tried to eat them. So that was, you know.
What was your dog's name?
Angie.
Angie loved bubbles.
She did. So yeah, that's tomorrow on Beltrami Avenue. Music starts tomorrow for the Beltrami Block Party. And that's made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And it should be a beautiful day.
Yeah, it is looking like. Later in the evening, there could be a chance of rain and thunderstorms. But through the day, we're looking at high 70s to low 80s, and we'll cool down as the night goes on. So you can't really ask for much more. And we sort of have your day set for you because you should tune in at 9 a.m. tomorrow. We've got the film heads. They're going to be on Heather Johnson, Andrew Dusingle, and Julie Crabb looking at movies from 1976, part of our look back for the 50th birthday of KXE. It was a big year.
It was, yeah.
Rocky, A Star is Born. I didn't realize. Oh, so it's the Kris Kristofferson.
Barbra Streisand.
Version, yeah. Huh. There you go. Lots of movies that came out in 76. Going to be a lot of fun to listen to that. I started watching an older movie last night. I don't know why, and I was pretty engaged by it. Did you ever see Tootsie?
I think I've seen Tootsie.
Yeah. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's... And then all the people in it now to see them, you know, Bill Murray is Dustin Hoffman's best friend and roommate, this playwright, and Jessica Lange and Terry Garr, who's just lovely, and Dabney Coleman. And so I didn't have time to watch all of it or anything. So, but that was not in 1976, but it was reminding me of that era of, mm-hmm. It was probably early 80s that one came out.
Yeah.
That's my guess. So we'd love to hear from you.
when you listen into that, if you want to talk about some of the movies you are seeing, anything you've seen in the, have you gone to the theater in a while?
I've not gone to the theater in a while, but let's see. I watched a few good movies lately. I watched Remarkably Bright Creatures with Sally Field.
That's right.
That's really good.
Okay. I need to watch that one. You recommended that.
It takes place in this small aquarium in the Pacific Northwest, and she's got this friendship with an octopus. A very sweet movie. And then I watched Eleanor the Great.
Oh, I loved that.
June Squibb. It was directed by Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah. And, that was a tougher movie than I expected, but I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
She was wonderful in it.
Yeah, Squibb. She kind of gets caught up in a lie. Mm-hmm. This older woman who gets caught up in a lie and kind of has to deal with that. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, really interesting movie. We'd love to hear from you. Give us some recommendations. 218-326-1234. We also want to know what's going on in your community. It was fun to talk to Aaron Brown yesterday about Iron Range events and things that are going on, street dances. He had some fun things to say about how if you're married to someone who grew up here, that the given is you're going to meet people from their past.
I heard the part about if somebody calls his wife Tina, he knows. He's like, what did he call it? Carbon dating?
Yes, yes. The friendship. But what we want to know is some things to do in small towns and in communities. The people who live in these places know sort of the secret places or the best place to get a ice cream cone or that kind of thing. Let us know. 218-326-1234. Very exciting, too. Our intern for the summer has the map done, has the information. It is published at kexe.org of as comprehensive as we could possibly be of the fireworks throughout the region.
Yes, and it is divided by kind of sub-region, you know, your northwestern Minnesota, your northeastern Minnesota. So thanks to Aaron Bowman for that. And it's called The Fourth Up North.
Yeah.
And find that at kexe.org.
Yeah, it is really quite insane of how many different people have fireworks. You know, how many small towns have them? What are you seeing
out
there?
I just saw a squirrel do a somersault.
I think that's a good sign for your day.
Okay.
We have, they are sort of acrobats. They walk the tightrope at my house, and here they're doing somersaults, so.
Support for KAXE comes from the Bagley Area Arts Collaborative, offering workshops in July, including Watercolor Batique with Diane, July 14th from 10 to 4 at Faith Lutheran Church in Bagley, and Expressive Watercolor Portrait Workshop, July 28th, 10 to 4, also at Faith Lutheran Church in Bagley. More information and registration at bagleyarts.org or on Facebook.
If you are a green cheese lover, which you probably are, we have a contest going on right now. It's a way for you to kind of make some history with green cheese. Design the next KEXE green cheese t-shirt. Like the live trivia show, we want your artwork to be fun, family-friendly, and unexpected. The deadline for this design on a green cheese t-shirt is July 8th. Submit your design at kexe.org/cheesecontest.
Yeah, and then coming up, hopefully then we'd have these shirts by the Green Cheese Picnic, which is August 8th.
That's the hope.
Yeah, we've had some fun shirts over the years, mm-hmm. and you could be part of that legacy.
That's right. It is time for our talkback segment of the Friday morning show. It's where we read your letters, we listen to your calls, and we read your texts that have come in during the week. We always want to hear from you, whether it's about programming, about what's going on in your region, or maybe a news tip. You can text us 218-326-1234.
So last week, KAXE's news team won 5 Page One awards from the Minnesota Society of Professional Journalists. We shared this news on Facebook, and Carmen commented, "Man, the KAXE news team hit their stride so quickly. Congratulations."
You are right, Carmen. We hired some amazing people that are really making their mark and making a huge difference in our communities. Yesterday, we talked with reporter Larissa Donovan about the one-year anniversary of last summer's derecho in Bemidji. Kim texted in, "At Bemidji State, the University in the Pines, it has been hard to see the damage. Early this summer, our alumni and facilities crew really stepped up to plant many, many new trees. There's hope for the future."
Yeah, I gotta say, I drove through there last winter for the first time after the derecho, and I went to BSU, so I was very familiar with that campus, and it hit me. It was like, whoa,
yeah,
this is tough. We got a note in the mail yesterday from Renner and Martha in Bloomington, along with a donation. They said, this is given in honor and thanks to Charlie Mitchell. We enjoy and learn from the Season Watch newsletter. So you can subscribe to that Season Watch email newsletter at kaxe.org. Also check out the Season Watch podcast as well. That's wherever you find your podcasts, or you can tune in to KAXE tomorrow at 1:30 or Sunday morning at 10:30 for the latest edition.
We got this note from Michelle. KEXE has been part of my life for more than 35 years, and thanks to the miracle of streaming, I still listen every day from my home in the Missouri Ozarks. I wanted to tell you how much it means to me that KEXE is invested in quality local and regional journalism. It is not easy to build a newsroom. It is a little like building a plane while you're flying it. And when I talk to people about public media, I hold up KEXE as the gold standard for how to make human-centered, human-powered, community-centered media with a sense of place. If I had $1 million, I'd give it to KEXE. Oh, those words are worth $1 million.
Yeah, thanks so much, Michelle.
And she's worked in media. She used to work at KEXE. I've heard about Michelle for years and years, and I'm so glad to hear that you are still listening.
Yeah. And Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors met this past Monday, and we have this report from Board Member Megan Maley.
Happy summer season. This is Megan Maley with the Northern Community Radio's on-air board report. The KAXE Board of Directors held their monthly meeting on June 22, 2026. It was called to order at 12:30 p.m. via Zoom. Congratulations to the KEXE News team, as they are the recipients of 5 SJP and Amuro Award for Excellence in Journalism. They are also excited to announce the expansion of their team with 2 new news reporters. Northern Community Radio is still looking to fill a development director and a business support manager position. If this sounds like a good fit for you or anyone you may know, please apply. Notable dates to add to your calendar. The Beltrami Block Party, formerly the Bemidji Block Party, will be held this weekend, June 27th. The KAXE KBXE Membership Drive will be July 27th through August 1st. The Green Cheese Picnic will be held at the KAXE Studio August 8th. Volunteer training at KAXE will be August 24th. And KAXE's Day at the State Fair will be held August 28th. New board members will be announced in August. A big thanks to our 2,505 sustaining members and to Bemidji Brewing for the proceeds from the People Powered Pilsner fundraising event. The meeting was adjourned at 1:20 p.m. The next board meeting will be held August 24th at the KAXE studio in Grand Rapids.
Thanks, Megan. Megan's one of our many volunteer board members that do their part to keep KAXE going. So many people behind the scenes. Those that are on air as well. Another way you can get a hold of us through our Season Watch podcast is to leave a SpeakPipe voice memo. And we had one that came in yesterday.
Last Sunday, while paddling along the north and east shore of Sand Lake in the Britt area, I noticed about a dozen clumps of yellow irises. In my 60 years of being on the lake, I have never seen a yellow iris on Sand Lake. Maybe I missed them. Or is this a sign of something?
I love an ending of a song like that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
A little mysterious?
That, yeah, that's like a little staticky or some other little bit of a sound, different sound. As Brother Wallace, the song was called A Patient Man. I thought of it because it seems like Steve on Sand Lake is very patient.
Oh, true.
Watching everything.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it takes sometimes. And the cool thing about Season Watch, you'll hear that it is out now. The latest podcast is, as you'll note from my participation in it, you don't have to know much.
No.
You just have to notice what's going on and be a little bit curious about what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So we hope that you will be a part of that Season Watch community. Sign up for the newsletter, sign up for the podcast, and just be a part of KEXE. This is how we do it. It's people like you. Coming up, we'll have the set list from Malachi Coons.
Hey, can I share a nature note?
Please do, yes.
Okay. So I saw a chipmunk the other night that had, I believe, a chipmunk baby in its mouth. Like, it was like how, you know, how cats carry their kittens?
Yeah.
It was kind of that situation, I think.
Unless it had killed something and
well, that's what I was confused about. Chipmunks don't do that, do they? Like, they're not carnivores.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess they're eating nuts, aren't they? Or yeah. Acorns?
But I don't know when they have their babies.
Right. That is a good, I mean, is this kind
chipmunk
of...
experts, yeah. Assemble. I need your help.
Andy Try will know this, the bear guy. We have a not similar situation, but we're watching Waiting for Babies at our house because we have a wood duck house this year.
Oh.
And the wood duck, we've been watching this, Tom found this article, it's great, about the jumpers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so excited for this. So we actually made a trail because it kind of goes down the hill that had a lot of weeds on it.
Yep.
Down to the lake so that, when the jumpers come out of the hole, that they'll have a path to go on. But the mom keeps coming back, and then we've kind of read up on it that we're going to hear a different call from her when it's time for the jumping.
Okay.
Of them to all jump out of the house and start their way.
So. Yeah. So this is in like a box, like a wood duck box.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fun thing is our nephew made it. Tom and our nephew made that last winter. And then now it's actually, we had one up there. It was like a plastic one that our neighbor gave us. And we never knew if anything was ever in there. We didn't see a lot of action. So it's just fun to see like what's going on. And then we just have had a lot of wildlife around our house lately of this fox. We had a bear. We think maybe there's a raccoon now that's trying to get into. We have some seed out on the deck. Mm. We think it's gotten up to the deck. There aren't stairs up to the deck. There's just a stick for the cat. we don't know what's going on, but it is a lot of things happening this summer, and hopefully you are noticing too, and we really would like to know if you have any information for Jennifer about these chipmunks. Okay, I'm looking here. It says chipmunks typically have babies twice a year. Early spring, February to April, and late summer, June to August. So June's in there.
Yeah.
After a 31-day gestation period, the mother gives birth to an underground litter, 2 to 8 pups. They're born blind, hairless, and helpless.
This was definitely hairless. And I have some holes in my yard where I believe that's their how they get to their underground lair.
Mm-hmm. Huh. That must be it, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah. At first I was like, what did that chipmunk kill? And then I was like, oh no, it's probably a baby.
Yeah. 218-326-1234. We would love to hear from you this morning. Right now it's time to find out some of the live music in our region.
This is the set list on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at one show Friday and two block parties Saturday, June 26th and 27th in Aiken, Grand Rapids, and Bemidji. Friday night, Allure is playing at Sampaguita in Aiken at 6 p.m. It's the in-your-face femme rock project of classically trained vocalist Elizabeth Hondur, who put out their terrific debut album, Blood Running, in 2023, full of catchy hooks and Gondour's skewering of gender roles and toxic masculinity. It's Allure this Friday in Aiken. There are two block parties this Saturday, and we will start off in Grand Rapids with the Pines' birthday block party beginning at noon. Taking place on Northwest 3rd Street in downtown Grand Rapids, the festival will feature performances from singer-songwriters Diddy Wish and Lane Newman, jazz from Sam Miltich, and the globe-trotting sounds of Tattletale closing out the night. The Pines Birthday Block Party all Saturday in Grand Rapids. And then in Bemidji, KAXC, KBXC, Bridget's Irish Pub, and Keg and Cork are presenting the first Beltrami Block Party at 1 p.m. on the 300 block of Beltrami Ave in downtown Bemidji. Six Minnesota musicians are on the lineup, with the Americana and rock fan favorite Eric Koskinen, folk rocker David Huckfeldt, and the indie rock sounds of Little Fevers, led by Lucy Michelle of the Velvet Lapels, plus local Bemidji musicians Cage Jamber, Sonny Johnson, and Tiny Town. The Beltrami Block Party all day Saturday in Bemidji. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at KAXC.org.
Coming up at 10 o'clock, it is
Minnesota Mixtape.
Thank you. Thinking about that, Malachi's also going to be joining us from his trip for Football is Life at 8:40. So it's getting a little mixed up.
He's going to be two places, not at once, but right. This morning.
That's right. And our own Andrew DeZingle with Headwaters beginning at 9 o'clock today. Coming up, we'll have the Up North Report, news from our region. This is 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. People-powered radio in northern Minnesota for 50 years. You can join us now at KAXC.org.
Partly sunny today, highs in the upper 70s, winds from the southeast 5 to 15. Mostly cloudy overnight with a slight chance of showers, lows 52 to 58, and partly sunny tomorrow. High 77 to 82. Southeast winds 10 to 15, gusting higher. For Saturday night, temps in the mid-50s to low 60s with a chance of rain and thunderstorms. And then on Sunday, showers with possible thunderstorms, highs in the upper 70s to mid-80s.
Lots of things going on throughout the region. Jennifer and I will be telling you about them. That includes Turtletown Art Fair at Salem Lutheran Church in Longville. That's tomorrow, 9 to 3. Shop local art while enjoying live music and food trucks.
Also tomorrow, the Minnesota Historical Society is offering free admission to all of its sites across the state. And northern Minnesota sites include Split Rock Lighthouse on the North Shore and the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids. Find a full list of those sites at mnhs.org/